start off the question and answer session with the questions that have been posted online. And then once we get through all of those questions, if time allows, we'll open up the phone for questions. Barbara, since you just gave your presentation, it's fresh in everybody's minds. I'm just going to start off with the questions that we have typed in for you. The first one is, you noted that containers now have surpassed coal on the railroads. What measure is used to define that?
I would say it would be probably gross tons. I would have to check that statistic. I'd have to go back and double check that. But it's probably tons originated.
Okay. The next question we have for you is, considering the expected population growth, what is FRA doing to increase capacity for passengers, such as commuter rail?
Well, FRA is really not in a position to do very much. Again, the railroads are privately owned. Many of the commuter rails, if they're publicly owned, they're generally owned by local communities. We did pass, most recently, I guess it was back in November, the new Rail Safety Act was passed, and there, that is a more forward-looking act, and there is some funding in there to take a look at high-speed rail. There are some grant programs, new grant programs for, again, local communities. So commuter rail is really more a local issue, and we look to the locals to propose to us or take on those programs themselves.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, we're now going to move on to some questions for Jim. And again, if you think of additional ones for Barbara, please type them in and we can always come back to them. Jim, is there any indication how the new administration views the Marine Highways Program?
Well, certainly the new president has talked about improving green alternatives, and we see the marine transportation as being part of that green solution. But until the new secretary gets on board and a new maritime administrator is appointed, we don't know of any change in policy. Basically, this is a win-win policy for everyone because it does address problems that we all share in congestion and air quality. So we don't anticipate any change in direction, but we won't know that for sure until the new maritime administrator is named.
Okay, thank you. Let's see, we have another question here for you. Could you please elaborate a little bit more on the European initiative regarding paying trucks €100?
Well, the new head of the program for the EEC is the former transport minister from Portugal, and he feels that the regulatory structure has not resulted in enough use of the waterways, and they continue to have increasing congestion problems on their highways. So he's trying to provide a tangible incentive to all the truckers in the EC to use ferries, and they have several services available over there. In fact, a little bit more than we have in the U.S. Because they've been at it for several years. But their ability to expand their highways is even more constrained than ours. They can't physically expand them in a lot of areas because they'd end up having to take whole towns out to do it. Although it's becoming more and more difficult for us to expand our highways in the urban areas, and it takes a long time and a lot of money to do that. We're currently talking anywhere between $5 and $30 million a mile to construct one lane of interstate. So there's a lot of dollars involved, a lot of time involved, and what we're trying to do is say that by using where it's available, marine transportation, we can defer some of that expansion and do it very efficiently.
Okay. Another question for you, is short sea shipping a serious alternative for goods traffic along much of the I-95 corridor?
Well, we think it's very, very feasible and very cost effective. In fact, short sea services, or marine highways as we're now calling them, probably has a bigger market for domestic trailer transport than the international container transport. The I-95 corridor, the I-10 corridor, I-5 corridor, these are all corridors of the future that have been designated by the Secretary of Transportation. And they're looking for innovative solutions. And we think that short sea shipping or marine highways is one of those solutions that could be implemented immediately and have a drastic impact on reducing congestion on all of those corridors.
Okay. We have a few more questions for you. Let's see here. Given the high cargo carrying efficiency of maritime transportation, what are the causes for such low marine domestic freight market share, only 2%? Are there important causes that the Marine Highways Program will not be able to address?
Well, I think the traditional problem for marine transportation is that it is necessarily slower than either rail or highway transportation. And if you're talking about high-value goods where the inventory carrying costs are substantial, they may not be susceptible to taking a form of transport that could be a day or two longer in terms of total transit time. But I think with the problems that we're facing in the urban areas with congestion and capacity of our infrastructure, the average speeds of highway transportation are being reduced every year because of the delays they're incurring, so that the time differential between water transport and other forms of surface transport is not as great anymore. But I still think for, in particular, very high-value cargoes, the inventory carrying cost is going to drive their supply chain design. But for medium and low value cargoes, the inventory carrying cost may only be $20 a day. So it's not significant enough to cause people not to look at water transport as an alternative.
Okay. Another question, was Hawaii a candidate for the Marine Highways Program? This person from Hawaii said they seem to recall the criteria causing Hawaii to be excluded.
Alaska is not excluded. Alaska has a marine highways service that goes all over the state, and it's been very successful and, in fact, provides about the only way to get to some of the islands that they serve. But all of the states in the United States and the U.S. territories, including Puerto Rico and Guam and American Samoa and the Virgin Islands are eligible for Marine Highways Program support.
You just to clarify, you had said Alaska just now, but did you mean Hawaii?
Alaska and Hawaii both.
Okay. I see. Okay. Would there be any initiative to revive some of the unused canals in the U.S., or are we strictly developing the major river systems to handle more traffic effectively?
There actually has been a significant effort to rejuvenate the Erie Canal for commercial traffic in the last year, and they're making substantial progress. I don't think they'll be physically expanding the canal, but it is now viewed as an alternative way to move some cargo across New York State. But most of the effort is focused on the inland waterways, the intra-coastal canals that we have, as well as the coastal waters that offer the ability for trailer ships and high-speed ferries to, you know, offer a competitive service to highway and rail on those corridors.
Thank you. We're going to move on to some questions for John now. John, do you have truck or bus crash data broken down by state?
Well, the crash data comes in from the states, and I really don't know to what extent it's broken down when it comes to us. What I would ask, if maybe the questioner would shoot me an email with their name and email address, and what I will do is have one of our data experts who work with the crash data information get back in touch with them and let them know what is available. I'm sure it's available at the state level, but when it's accumulated up to the federal level coming from all the different states, I'm not sure if we're actually getting the crash location information as well.
And that's actually, we have a second similar question asking about if crash location data is available, so I'd recommend that person also emails John for the further information. Okay, let's see here. We have a few questions. That's all we have in for John right now, but again, if you think of anything else, please type them in. We have a few questions that actually I think could go for more than one presenter. This one looks like it would be for both Barbara and Jim, and that's, how do you integrate and plan for current and future conflicts and rail bridge openings for higher rail usage for both passenger and freight, and increased use of marine corridors by marine freight and recreational boating? And I'll let either one of you jump in for that one.
I think I'll defer on that one.
Okay, well, I'll attempt to answer it. Basically, you know, marine highways as an extension of the highway and railroad networks only works where there's an adjacent waterway. But certainly when we are doing our planning for the development of the domestic transportation system, we need to think about the marine alternative, particularly in high-volume corridors where a substitute service could come in using existing or even potentially new facilities to transfer cargo to either a ship or a ferry or a barge and tug combination. One of the things that we've tried to encourage the MPOs to do is to look at what the volume of traffic, of truck traffic in particular, is in major corridors that run adjacent to either the inland waterways or the coastal waters, and see if there might be enough volume there to support trailer ship or container on barge services that would allow them to have some breathing room before they have to expand the highway system through some of the urban corridors. And the other part of it is, it's a pretty substantial decrease in maintenance costs if you can remove some of the truck traffic from both the interstate and U.S. highway systems in these urban areas. So that is a calculation that has to be done locally by the state DOTs or the MPOs based on their topography and costs of maintaining the highways, but it is a pretty substantial reduction if you can reduce the volume of truck traffic.
Okay, thank you. This next question is for Barbara. I understand rail is nearing capacity. Do you have to reduce freight capacity in order to increase passenger rail availability?
I'm sorry. Can you run that by me again? I apologize.
Sure. The question is, I understand rail is nearing capacity. Do you have to reduce freight capacity in order to increase passenger rail availability?
Well, that's a good question. We're really not at that point yet. The railroads, first of all, we're not particularly looking, the railroads are not particularly looking to increase passenger rail availability at this point in time. There is a proposal out, actually it came from Congressman Micah, looking for basically ideas, concept ideas for high-speed rail projects in the United States. And these, again, this is just a request for concept papers, but I don't know as though there are any plans directly underway to increase passenger service at this point in time. Now, again, the bigger question is the capacity for the freight railroads, and they are looking at technological innovations to help improve capacity from that perspective, and one that the department and the FRA has really encouraged is with ECP brakes, which are the electronically controlled pneumatic brakes. And the BNSF, for instance, is operating these brakes coming out of the Powder River Coal Basin very successfully. And what that does is reduce stopping distance and really provide for more accurate operation of the trains. So at this point in time, I don't see where we're really even looking into the impact of increased passenger rail on the freight system. That's really not an issue yet. But we are looking at this point in time at technological innovations for solving some of the more immediate problems.
Okay, thank you. Again, this one I think is for Jim and Barbara. Given the environmental benefits of water and rail transport of freight, is there much being done connecting inland waterway service in the east with western rail service?
Well, there currently is not a direct service, but there are some people that are looking at what is might be considered a reverse land bridge. People probably know the first double-stack container service in the U.S. was from Houston to Southern California. Because of the movement of import containers through the San Pedro Bay ports of Long Beach and Los Angeles to the Midwest and East Coast, there is an opportunity to look at moving those by rail to Texas and then putting them on a ship to go to various East Coast ports. But these are all niche markets. A lot depends on the volume and the type of commodities that are being moved and what type of vessel is employed so that the overall transit time can be competitive with a land bridge rail movement or a combination rail and truck movement.
Barbara, do you have anything to add to that?
No, I really don't. Again, the railroads are not looking to develop new routes or new lines at this point in time. So if you're looking to connect the railroads better to the inland waterways, that really has not been studied yet. Not to say it's not an absolutely good option and the way to go, but to my knowledge, nothing is underway at this time.
Okay, thank you. We have another question for Jim. Do you have any comments on the impact of the harbor maintenance tax on the increased use of the Great Lakes for NAFTA movements?
Well, yes, the harbor maintenance tax is an issue that we face, not just the tax itself, but the mechanism by which it's levied on domestic cargo. And there are several efforts underway within Congress to provide an exemption from the harbor maintenance tax for domestic cargoes or cargoes that move on our marine highway system. It's difficult for me to forecast whether those will be successful or not, but it certainly is an issue that we face on further development of the marine highways. As I mentioned, it's not just the amount of the tax, but it is the mechanism by which the tax is billed to the beneficial owner of the cargo. And on domestic movements, those carriers currently don't have a system by which they can do that, where on the international cargoes, it's done through the custom brokerage process. So it is an issue we're aware of. The new Marine and Highways Advisory Board, I'm sure, will be looking at that and recommending some solutions, but separately, that it's been recognized as an issue by several members in both the House and Senate, and I expect there'll be at least a few legislative initiatives in this Congress to try and address that.
Okay, thank you. I don't see anything else typed in at this moment, so we'll go ahead and open the phone lines for questions and see if anybody has any questions over the phone. Stacy, if you could give instructions on how to do that.
Thank you. At this time, if you would like to ask a question from the phone, please press star 1. You will be prompted to record your first and last name. To withdraw your request, press star 2. Once again, to ask a question from the phone, please press star 1 and record your name. One moment, please. But at this time, I'm showing no questions from the phone.
Okay, thank you. John, Jim, or Barbara, are there any questions that might have been sent directly to you that I didn't see that I might have missed?
I had one question here. Does FMCSA have a position on the issue of increasing CMV, maximum gross weight, i.e. 80,000 pounds to 97,000 pounds? And I guess I would say that We approach each of these situations from the safety side of it. So an 80,000 pound gross vehicle weight rated vehicle has certain components in the braking systems and the structural capacity of the vehicle that allow it to transport safely that amount of weight. There are some tractor trailers that might have a gross vehicle weight rating of 60,000 pounds, and so they would have different levels or different types of brake componentry and other componentry that would impact the gross vehicle weight rating, which is set by the manufacturer of the vehicle. Again, using manufacturing standards that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has developed for the manufacturer. So from our standpoint is that, if you're dealing with a heavier vehicle, we would expect to see that the vehicle has been designed and manufactured by the manufacturer so that it has sufficient braking and control capacity that's equal to the braking and control capacity of a vehicle with a gross vehicle rating of 80 or 60 or 40,000 pounds. So we approach those types of discussions from the purely safe operation standpoint, not the capacity side.
Thank you.
This is Jim Pugh. There was a question on the chat board there directed to me asking how a state such as Wyoming could benefit from the Marine Highways Program. Those states, and there's six or seven of them, that don't currently have waterways or coastal waters adjacent to them, don't have a direct opportunity to develop marine highways, but they still could benefit by adjacent states having a marine highways program that might divert some of the truck or rail traffic from a corridor that would then not go into those states that don't have a marine system. That's the only potential benefit I could see.
Okay, thank you. We did have another question come in for Barbara. Barbara, can you briefly describe what the Surface Transportation Board does and how it relates to FRA and its programs?
Sure. Now, I'm not the absolute expert on the SURF Board, and there are others in FRA that are, but I can answer that question generally. And if my response is not satisfactory, whoever's asking the question, if you shoot me an email, I can get you more details on that. But generally, what the Surface Transportation Board does is it does hear cases presented to it from the railroad sector. For instance, right now there's a case to acquire a line that runs around Chicago by a Canadian Railroad, or the EJ&E, I believe it is, to acquire this line. Cases like that would go before the Surface Transportation Board. What FRA does is we absolutely do review the case, and we provide input or comments to the Surface Transportation Board, but we do not have a say in what they do. We merely provide to them an analysis of the project from our perspective. I don't know if that answered your question appropriately, and if not, you know, I'd be more than happy to take an email and get some further details on that for you.
Thank you. And did I miss anything for you, Barbara, that I might have not seen?
Yeah, there was one also, very similar type issue. Not similar, but let me get up to it. Here we go. This came from a gentleman from Indiana DOT, and his question was, freight rail congestion is prominent in Chicago. Can US DOT FRA provide incentive for the Class 1 railroads to find or develop routes to bypass Chicago? Again, if you would send me an email, I will get you details on that. There is a case before the Surface Transportation Board right now for exactly that. It's for, I believe it's the EJ&E, but I don't want to say for certain because I've really not been involved directly in this case. I should know more about it. I'm within the office that is doing the analysis on it, but I just don't know off the top of my head, and I don't want to give any incorrect information. So if you would shoot an email to me, I will get you some of the particulars of that case currently before the STB, which is exactly supposed to do that, relieve some of the congestion going through Chicago, and they're talking about developing a loop, a bypass route around. There are a lot of issues I know with regards to the environmental study, and I do believe it's very, very, very close to a decision by the STB, and I'd be happy to share or get more details on that and share those with you.
Okay, thank you. That's all the questions that we have for right now. So I
do have one question on the phone.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Okay. Dave, your line is open.
Hi, this is Dave Crushwitz. I'm with the Surface Transportation Board. And I did want to respond to the question about interface between rail and water, between the Western rail carriers and the water carriers. And I think the answer was kind of given from the perspective, perhaps, of containerized and of the marine highway. And there is a whole other aspect here. There is considerable goods movement moving by rail and then transferring to water, and some vice versa, all up and down the inland waterways. Primarily, it's coal coming out of the Powder River Basin and then going into the barge lines, but there's also, obviously, a tremendous amount of grain traffic, which is moving by rail and then going by barge all up and down the river, fertilizer as well, and as well as chemicals and other bulk commodities. So it is there is a lot of interface between the two. No, there isn't a lot of containerized movement.
Thank you. I appreciate you getting on and clarifying that.
One moment, we have one more.
Mary Lee, your line is open.
Hello. I have two questions, actually. I have one for Mr. Steinhoff. Could you give a brief description regarding each of the grant programs that are listed on the second to the last page of your presentation?
I can either do that for the group, or I could give you a call back, and it depends on what everybody is interested in.
If you want to quickly go through, I'll pull up that slide again, and if you do want to just maybe quickly go through each one, that's fine.
All right. Well, basically, on that slide, it I think it's one before that. Okay, there it is. The MCSAP program, basically deals with reimbursements to the states for personnel and equipment costs associated with roadside inspections, compliance reviews, new entrant audits, public education, data improvements, drug alcohol enforcement, traffic law enforcement, all related as it relates to commercial motor vehicles. And in 2009, the request is for before Congress, we're in a continuing resolution right now, for $209 million. That's an 80-20 matching grant. Then there's the next one is border enforcement grants, and these are to the border states to help to ensure that the motor carriers operating into the United States from either Canada or Mexico are in compliance. And the request in 2009 is for $32 million for that, and that's 100% money. Commercial driver's license program improvement grants. Basically, again, I mentioned briefly about the commercial driver's license program, and so this is a grant that's available to help improve state CDL programs, and the request for 2009 was $25 million, and that's also 100% money for the state. C-Vision is a mechanism to encourage the states and the motor carrier industry to develop and deploy electronic information systems and communication networks, with an overall goal to improve the quality and timeliness and access of motor carrier safety and credentials data, a lot of it alongside the roadway at real time. The 2009 request is for $209 million, and that's a 50-50 matching grant. There's another one called PRISM. That deals with basically tying together the federal motor carrier safety information systems with the state commercial vehicle registration and licensing system. And basically, it's a mechanism to make sure that companies that have been declared unsafe and placed out of service by us, that they then would lose the ability to go into a state licensing agency, and because of that agency's lack of information about our action, would give license plates to a carrier who shouldn't have them. And so that's what that basic concept is. It's the request for 2009 was $5 million, and that's 100% money. And the other one is safety data improvement grants, and that's to help to improve the accuracy and completeness and timeliness of commercial data. Obviously, the more information that's available on the actual on-highway performance, and the quicker that information is brought together into a single database, allows us then to direct our limited resources more effectively to the companies that actually need the visits and the attention. Those grants are $3 million. That's an 80-20 grant. And then the commercial driver's license information system. Again, this is a network through which the various state licensing agencies communicate information back and forth regarding commercial driver's license violations and driver status. There's a modernization program that's been authorized by Safety Lou, and the request is for 2009 is $8 million, and that's, again, an 80-20 matching grant. So that's a brief summary.
Okay, thank you. And Mary Lee, you had another question, you said?
Yes, I do. It would be for, let's see, I can't remember her name.
Barbara?
What I wanted to know is, at one point, Wyoming had Amtrak that went across the southern portion of the state, and we have been told that that particular rail line, since they took Amtrak off and now it's been used for freight, that particular line would no longer be suitable for passenger rail traffic. And I was just wondering if you have any information on that throughout the nation, and if that sounds like a reasonable statement. And also, if you could repeat again the type of braking system that's used by BNSF in the Powder River Basin area.
Sure. I'm going to answer the easy question first. And the new it's ECP, and it's electronically controlled pneumatic brake. And those are being used elsewhere. I believe CSX has them in use, and I think CSX and BNSF are the two railroads utilizing those at this point in time. Now, with regards to the rail line in Wyoming and its conversion or removal, it sounds like, of passenger service to freight exclusively, and then you're saying that the line is no longer fit for passenger service. I'm going to, if I may, request if he's still on, there's a gentleman by the name of Joe Connolly from Federal Railroad Administration. He is one of our safety inspectors. I am not as familiar with the intricacies of classifications and what a line really needs to qualify for certain operating speeds and the like, and that actually it's a very detailed question, and I'm wondering if Joe's there, and I know this is not exactly his area because his specialty is hazardous materials, but he might have a better response for you with regard to the actual differences in safety requirements for passenger operations versus freight operations. And if Joe's not there, email me and we'll get an I'll get an answer to your question, but maybe Joe can pop in at this point and shed a little bit more light on that question for you.
Okay, thank you.
And Joe, yeah, if you are on the line.
One moment.
A lot may have to do with train control. Speeds are regulated by the engineering standards for the track, also by the signaling systems, and by the train control systems in use on the passenger trains, which limits speed on some of the lines. Now, I have no idea what happened on this particular line, and I guess we could find out why that is, and if you really want me to, I will call a couple of people that I know and find out exactly what happened out there. But there literally could be a myriad of reasons. A lot has to do, again, Barbara talked about capacity before. One of the things FRA has set up a pilot project for is a thing called positive train control. You've probably read a lot about it since the accident out in California. And positive train control means positive train separation, which will also increase capacity, safety, and actually speeds of trains, because we'll be able to know exactly where they are instead of just being able to roughly locate where some of these trains are. So I honestly don't know the answer to your question. I can tell you that there could be a ton of reasons for that. And I can give you my email address. It's Joe, J-O-E, .connelly, @dot.gov. And if you write to me about that particular circumstance, I promise I'll find you an answer.
Thank you, Joe.
Yes, ma'am.
Do we have any other questions on the line?
There are no further questions from the phone.
Okay. Well, we are almost out of time, so we're going to go ahead and close out for today. I want to thank all three presenters for three great presentations, and thank you for all the questions that we had there. As I mentioned before, the recording and the presentations and a transcript will all be available online in the next few weeks, and I'll send an email when those become available. I briefly just wanted to bring up a slide about the Freight Peer-to-Peer program. This program puts public sector freight transportation professionals in touch with experts in the field and provides technical assistance in order to enhance overall freight skills and knowledge. The program is available to public entities such as state DOTs and MPOs. If you want to learn more about the program, please visit the website, or if you're interested in serving as a peer, you can visit the website as well and learn more about the program and how to apply. The next seminar is going to be held on February 18th, and we're still in the process of working on that seminar, so more information will be sent soon through the Freight Planning Listserv regarding the topic and registration. And one other thing I wanted to mention was in May, we're going to be having a seminar on the size and weight debate, which is kind of relevant to today's discussion, in which we'll be giving an overview of the current size and weight allowance and the pros and cons to changing the limits. So more information about that seminar will be coming out within the next few months. With that, we're going to close out for today. Thank you, everybody, and enjoy the rest of your day.